Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast.
Hello, Slackers, and welcome to the Slacker Podcast. It is, what season are we on now? Season 100? I think we're on season 5, and we've been sort of like dipping into it slightly and slowly throughout the year with a little bit of Moby, a little bit of Bicep, a little bit of Royal Blood, and some Kojak. I'm giving you the best guests. And if you are fresh to it, and this is the first time you've ever listened to the Slacker Podcast, it is a one-to-one interview with either an artist or a band, and it really revolves around the early days of the group. And we do that best by jumping back into their musical discography and winding the way back to the very, very beginning and looking for that early demo. Speak a little bit about an early demo that they've made and see how they've kind of grown out of that and turned into the big beautiful oak tree that we all come to know and love. Thank you for listening to the Slacker Podcast. If you need a suggestion for another show, my show that is only available on Spotify is called Chill Da Beats. It's Chill Da Beats. I mean, like, how long have I been doing this show and I'm still getting it wrong? And it is 2.5 hours every single Sunday, and it's all about the best, most relaxing, chill music that there is out there. It's like, we're not talking boring lift music here, people. We're talking, like, you know, really trailblazing new artists, some really exciting sounds from like lo-fi dance music, from folk music, from hip-hop music, from like real traditional songwriting, from retro to old. It really tries to like run the gambit of music of the 21st century. And you know, if you have a little bit of stress in your life, a little bit of anxiety, then I suggest you get on it and have a little listen to it. If you like, you can support the Patreon as well. On Chill Da Beats, you get loads of new episodes weekly. patreon.com/chilldabeats. And if you are a slacker, you can support Slacker on patreon.com/slackerpodcast. It is time, my friends, now to introduce you to, it's Graham Coxon. I know, like, I was gonna give him the big sell before even saying who it was, but it's Graham Coxon, the guy with the most legendary British guitar sound of the 90s. He really took a real US sound and brought it to the big Union Jack easel that was Blur in the early 90s. He's an absolute legend of a man. He's like done some great stuff outside of Blur as well, which we talk about quite a lot. And I had a great time talking to him and just nerding out. So here it is, our Slacker Podcast with Graham Coxon in 3, 2, 1. It's a Slacker Podcast, and we've got our guest, Graham Coxon, who, like, it looks like a massive sort of like laboratory that you're in, like a music studio. Like, what is it?
Well, it's not massive. Look.
Yeah, that's fair. One, two, three, four, and in back. Three, four.
Yeah, it's just a little spare room where I am at the moment, but there's a lot piled up. Yeah, yeah, this is where I've been working at the moment. And it's small, easy to manage, and just has got the required things to be able to make music and nothing more, really. Well, it's got some storage up there, which is full of crap. But basically, yeah, there's a couple of guitars.
What else do you need? You've got a little bass over your shoulder. I can see as well.
There's a six-string bass there. There's a bass up there. There's some keyboardy bits, a tiny pink guitar.
Graham.
Tambourines, of course.
A six-string bass is punishable by death in yeah, well, it is for me. Like, I've been a bass player since I was about 12, 13. And I've always thought if you have five strings or six strings, I'm just like, what, like, unless you're like playing in like Funkadelic or something like that.
Yeah.
Four strings is enough.
Well, no, because this is a 1968 Fender Bass 6. So you play it like a guitar.
Okay. Right. I get you. I thought it was the bass over your other shoulder.
Oh, no, that's just a normal jazz bass.
That looks amazing.
Here it used to belong to.
Is that Sly from Sly and the Family Stone?
Yeah.
Shut up.
So you can eat your words.
I'm going to eat them. With the most tasty dressings and dessert.
I bought that in the mid-90s from Black Market Music in Los Angeles. And Larry Graham had just dropped off a whole bunch of rubbish that they didn't want anymore. And that was a 1968 Bass 6, which I snapped up and I used all the time. It's fantastic. Yeah.
Wow. What's your most prized like guitar? Maybe you've got a couple, like, but like, which one is the one that you sort of reach for first out of all of them?
But I wouldn't know. Well, I've got prized guitars, like my old Jazzmaster, my old Telecasters. I don't know whether I prize them that much. I've got an old Les Paul Gold Top, but you know, it's kind of like what's there in your toolbox, isn't it?
Mm.
So whatever can do the most things, and at the moment there's that thing down there, which was made for me by Adrian from Manson Guitars.
Yeah,
who was introduced to me by Matt Bellamy, and we've got together and made that, and it's got sort of whatchamacallits on it, and sustainiac stuff you can hold a note forever, and
yeah,
and kind of other helpful gizmos. So I'm very much into convenience and workflow. So, you know, obviously if I want a twangy, very Fendery sound, I'll have to maybe dig something out. But and my acoustic guitars, like old little Martin 00018s or 17s or whatever they are. 00018.
Yeah. I mean, like, if you wanted, you probably could have just a room dedicated to just all of the guitars, but it's probably better just to have a couple of the ones that you really like. Otherwise it turns into a bit of a museum, doesn't it?
Yeah, that would be sort of 75 guitars, which would be too many in here. I wouldn't be able to use the room. I've got a Strat, and then I have a Friedman guitar.
What's your least favorite guitar? Because obviously there's so many great ones that you're talking about, but is there one that you're just like, oh my God, like, get this away from me?
Well, I struggle with Stratocasters. Although I do play them, I struggle with the ergonomics of one of those, because I come from I don't like knobs in the way. You know, and the more I see sort of YouTubers and the way they play, I realize they have their little finger on the volume knob on Stratocasters, and they're doing this so they can turn down very fast. But I was never into turning my volume knob down or using any kind of knobs. They were always just full up, full tone, full volume. So really, most of my guitars could just have all the knobs removed. They just get in the way for me.
Have you ever seen anybody do an instructional video on YouTube about your sound? Because obviously, you know, like you, there are people who do these videos, and you have such a signature sound. Like, have you ever watched somebody try and get?
I have. I've seen, you know, Andy, the YouTube guitar player. He's kind of a bit of a fan, and when he's demonstrating pedals, he'll sometimes, you know, try and do the Chemical World sound or do some other weird, like Peter Panic or something, some old B-side of Blur where I'm using tremolo and vibrato and, you know, all at the same time and things like that. And people, they make it more difficult than it is. it is difficult playing somebody else's stuff. I mean, I play how I play, and for me, it's kind of easy. But when I go and try to play somebody else's things, obviously, it's kind of like their fingers, and we all habitually have the way our fingers like to go, and at our own sort of touch. I suppose we develop a touch after a while, which is very much a part of how we sound. Which is a lot like, you know, when you hear people say, oh, you could pick up a flipping broomstick and make it sound brilliant. It's because they've developed this touch over years and years of playing. So they can make cheap instruments sound like expensive instruments. That's what they say.
Is there like a sound in particular that you've wanted to like replicate or try to replicate and just can't get near?
I don't, well, not really.
Yeah. Like, was there, like,
I don't know. Like, some of the 80s stuff, that's getting crazy. I mean, you can chuck a load of chorus and vibrato and flanges and phasers and stuff like that and things. And I've never been into chorus an awful lot. I've used flanges a little bit. But, you know, things like maybe Cocteau Twins, you know, something like that. If I listen to that, I'm trying to work out what's happening with the guitars. And actually, they're quite sort of thin and nasty sounding guitars at times, you know. But as part of the whole, they make a lot of sense. And they occupy a certain territory within the old sonic geography. But a lot of that is sort of chorusing and things like that, and a lot of 80s sort of sounds. Sometimes I have to try and replicate my own stuff, which gets more difficult when you have lost pieces of equipment that were sort of integral to that sound.
Mm.
So I have to trawl Reverb or eBay sometimes and try and get those old pedals back, like an old Alesis MIDI Verb. Mm. And things like that for sounds that I used on B-sides in, say, 1993. You know, there's certain sounds I used to use. I used in Oily Water and Bone Bag and Peach, which are sort of almost like really me trying to be Robert Fripp in a lot of ways. And trying to have, which in a lot of ways, that's why this Manson guitar is good, because you can flick that switch and you can hold a note rather like an Ebo, and it will go on forever. But you can all, there's also another switch which will kind of bring out other harmonics. So you can make it lose control a little bit and go into notes that are sort of harmonically related to the one you're playing and all this. So it's kind of it's good fun. I like the idea that, you know, you're playing. That's why I use sort of two or three distortion units on it at the same time, because you're never quite sure what the sound is going to do. And I like the way that the guitar might flick up into feedback on a certain note and make me then respond. So I've never been super, you know, scaly.
Yeah.
Theoretically together. And that's probably why notes that may not be there, if I'd have studied lots of scales, are there, because people who do study scales perhaps maybe within a zone far too often, and you know, and I like the freedom rather like painting, and you get the odd drip, you know, you get the odd bum note, but sometimes you get notes that are sort of more interesting and sort of a bit more
They kind of bend the song into like a something that's slightly out of shape, and but also a little bit more lovable and a little bit more warm. And I guess that's what you get with demos as well, because we have a demo of Yoga Town that we're gonna blast in now. Right. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll head it in and we'll talk about it off the back. This is Graham Coxon, Yoga Town.
Yoga Town, this is my
that was Yoga Town on the Slacker podcast. So like what's the timestamp on that? Like when did you write that? And what do you
And say? That was by Superstate, not Graham Coxon.
Oh, by Superstate, sorry, apologies. Much apologies. I only got sent that there literally minutes ago, so I'm not fresh around it. Can you tell me a little bit about the Yoga Town track?
Yeah, it's a chord sequence, and it's almost like you can think of it as episode one if you're watching a Netflix series. It's sort of presenting a sort of a situation that's kind of quite trivial, I guess, but then there's it's kind of spot the problem, spot the issues, and then that it sort of reveals itself as it goes along that Yoga Town maybe doesn't sound quite as idealist as ideal, ideal, quite as an ideal place to live as the name might suggest. I mean, I started writing these songs for Superstate about. Actually, the first one I wrote was on the day David Bowie died. So that's kind of getting on now.
Yeah.
So over the last four or so years, I mean, it's been finished for over a couple of years. So it's been sitting fermenting.
And like you mentioned like the sort of like the Netflix association, like, and I wanted to talk to you about that at some point during the podcast, about the end of the fucking world and composing and putting stuff like that together. Like, you know, like that, what sort of, was that something that was always in the plan for you, or like, is that something that you just gravitated towards quite naturally?
I didn't, it was never the plan, and I got pulled towards it. I was approached by a music supervisor called Matt Biffa. First of all, I did the outro song for a film called Riot Club. That was a few years ago, which was based around the Billenden Club in Oxford, in the universities there. And I did a sort of a song for the outro. The thing is, I'd never really done anything like this. And so when I was invited to do a song, I had no real setup at home. So I thought, well, I'll get an interface and I'll get Logic and I'll sort of, you know, give it a go. So I was in at the deep end really there. And so I got a demo together, and luckily I could go into a real studio and record some of it, vocals and things like that. So it turned out all right.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
What Matt did was a big favor for me, really, because it made me get an interface, get Logic, and start recording at home and start demoing at home instead of an old hard disk recorder that I used to have and a sort of a drum machine that I used to hit the pads and so I could actually make demos that were reasonably decent. I'm, you know, learning as I went. you know, just bought a microphone, and then I bought a preamp, and now I sort of have some audio interfaces, and I have a preamp. I put it in the and I just learned as I went along, and had to, and when the end of the fucking world came along, it was I had to work fairly fast. I'd never really done this before, and my studio sort of expanded slightly. My workflow developed from no workflow at all to, so I just learned it all on the fly, really. So luckily the doing the soundtrack work was actually a good way of me developing a workflow, practicing writing instrumental stuff, and then songs that were relevant to whatever scene or whatever episode or whatever temporary track that they had there. So it was excellent. So Matt got me on that road, and obviously there was a second series of End of the Fucking World as well. And so that process carried on, and then another one called I'm Not Okay With This, which I sort of had to then invent a band. A band was invented in that show, and I had to make the album for that band.
I haven't seen this yet, but that must have been really fun. Like, that must have been like a real exercise in going, look, I can create a band, not have to tour it, not have to like go through any press, not have to go through any of the bullshit that you really don't want to do.
Yeah, it was fantastic, because they were an amalgamation of a lot of my favorite sort of indie bands from the 80s. You know, they were a bit of My Bloody Valentine, they were a bit of Jesus and Mary Jane, they were a bit of Tallulah Gosh, they were a bit of, you know, all of that kind of thing, a bit of the Ramones, all into one group. And I ended up writing 11 songs. You know, only about three of them were in the TV show, but I thought it'd be great to actually write an album for that band.
Mm.
They were called Blood Witch. And there's a topic on YouTube with Blood Witch and all of the songs there. And so they're all meant to sound like those big sort of 80s sorts of.
Yeah.
But that was excellent fun, because that group in my head developed from beginning kind of like quite cutesy, developing through to getting sort of bigger and more choral and a little more folk horror. So that they actually developed as musicians, and in with their sonics and their sonic noodlings as well.
Have they developed in your head? Like, I mean, have they broke up? Have they had the drug addictions? Have they been to Japan? Have they been all around the world? Have they fallen?
I think they definitely went to Japan, and I think they probably. There was probably a relationship with the singers that is now no more, but yeah, they may be able to do another album if they can get along. But because they were doing some really good stuff before they broke up.
Yeah, I think, like, do you know what? There must have been like a great like therapy in that as well. Like, you'd be able to just like just let it go and just like hammer out a load of tracks and just go, this is. I would find that quite freeing, knowing that like there's everything's kind of inconsequential for what comes out of it, other than the joy of music and making it.
Yeah, it is great, and in a way, like with the End of the Fucking World stuff, it was a lot of the temporary songs could have come from any era. You know, they could have been things from you know, Scott Walker to the Beach Boys to then early 90s Beck to then Devo. You know, so it was really good fun to try and put an era to the song I was making. So make something sound like 1968, make something sound like the early 90s, make something sound like it was from 1979, make something sound, you know, but also use my voice differently to try and not be me. And I realized I could say an awful lot more when I wasn't having to be me.
Mm.
A lot more risky with lyrics.
Yeah,
I was sort of playing a part like an actor.
Do you think there's a similarity there, like with what you're saying there, and with what Damon does with Gorillaz? Because like he can kind of do what he wants behind these cartoon characters, and you can kind of do what you want behind this like imaginary band, and it kind of gives you a little bit more artistic license to not have to open yourself up in a raw way, but be able to kind of say what you really want to say?
I guess there's a similarity, but I shouldn't have to do that. I should be able to not play a part and be able to say what I want to say. I always sort of have done, but I think Graham Coxon has always dwelt on, you know, whining about stuff, and he's been quite open about, you know, depressive episodes, you know, and things like that, which I think, you know, I still get a lot of feedback from on things like Twitter that my songs have helped people through difficult patches. And you know, I listened to something, a lot of things when I was growing up that were pretty open about that sort of thing too. And it lets you know that you're not alone, you know, that other people feel this way, and it's temporary mostly, and it's not weird, and you're not weird, and you're not bad for feeling or thinking this stuff. But in a way, it's kind of good to, it's interesting, like with the Blood Witch stuff, because that band, I know I gave them certain obsessions, you know, and they turned into, like I mentioned, like a sort of a folk horror thing. Some of their songs ended up being quite occultish, you know. Obviously, they started to have an interest in hanging out in the woods and
burning churches.
not quite as
far as Norwegian doom.
I don't really understand burning churches down.
No, I don't.
Like small campfires and you know, small ceremonies.
Is there an aspiration to move into like cinema and film scores from this? Like I was speaking to Tom York not too long ago about him doing Suspiria, and it was like the first proper score that he had done. And how much he enjoyed that. Like, I mean, would you like to get your hands around a horror movie, or if you could, what sort of style of movie would you like to do?
Yeah, horror movies are a good one to do, aren't they? I don't know. I mean, I'm not adverse to it. I do like working in purely instrumental. In a purely instrumental way, I kind of enjoy it. And in a way, putting songs onto things that have lyrics, you have to be careful how narrative you can get. You have to be sort of vague enough to be getting a feeling across, but leave enough space for the listener to for them to put their own thoughts and feelings within the song, not be too specific. Doing purely instrumental stuff, you don't have to think about that at all. You can purely think of in sonic terms of how to amplify the sort of the emotional drive of the scene or whatever's going on. So I do like the idea of it. Totally, yeah.
I wanted to ask you about your the first instrument that you owned. Was it a guitar? Was it a classical instrument? Because I know your dad played in the British Army. What was the first instrument?
A fife, I think. There was one of those knocking around. There was also a little drum kit I was knocking about with. The first instrument I was taught properly was the saxophone when I was 11.
Yeah,
and I still use that on stuff I write, and so that was it, really. A very little simple system, sort of piccolo, really, and a drum kit, And then there was a guitar lying about that was my sister's, I think. And I decided to sort of on a bored day on the school holidays, I just picked it up.
Mm-hmm. Can you remember? I've seen something. Can you remember your first riff, like the first one that you sort of like wanted to finger on it?
It was probably either Aunties and Uncles or Liza Radley, which were both jam B-sides, that just were A, D and E, really. So that they were very simple. And I liked that. It was one of my favourite little songs when I was, you know, Liza Radley. It's a B-side of Start.
The early jam stuff was incredible. But when you pick up the guitar for the first time, you learn a couple of chords. It's great because you're kind of off to the races. But when you start learning how to play things individually on different frets, like a solo or an actual riff, it becomes like a whole different instrument, doesn't it?
I guess. Yeah. I mean, blues is a kind of a good thing to get going on. Because the blues scale isn't too difficult. You can stick to the dots on the neck, and so you can actually sort of play a couple of Cream numbers quite early on if you want to, and get into. I mean, when I was growing up, when this was the mid '80s, so still learning from people like the Beatles and Jimi Hendrix and Cream and things like that was still okay, you know. That's where a lot of guitar players would be learning their stuff from. But now, I mean, it's different. I mean, gosh, there's been a lot more bands since then and a lot more changes in aesthetic music and pop music and rock music and what it all means. So I don't know what they would be doing now.
You never got into that whole sort of like hair metal style of playing, like Iron Maiden, Pinch Harmonix, Judas Priest, that whole sort of like British, like heavy metal scene? Because I feel like I definitely had a period of it for about a year or so when I was a teenager, just playing Run to the Hills and stuff like that, just because it's ridiculously fun to play.
It is good fun, yeah. I mean, I liked Rainbow. I mean, but that was sort of chart music, wasn't it? You know, it was sort of in the late 70s, you know, The Number of the Beast, which is strange. I was listening to that the other day. It's excellent fun.
If you go into Iron Maiden with the idea of going, this is meant to be enjoyed as like performance, as like, you know, not to be sat down and critically pulled apart. Like they've got a big fucking 20-foot monster called Eddie walking around stage while they're playing solos. Do you know what I mean?
And The Number of the Beast is a great video because they have a pair of dancers come on the stage and then suddenly the woman has this sort of werewolf head on. It's like, what? it's very cheap and nasty, but great, you know. And his voice is nuts. It's got some really cool bits. But Bruce Robinson, he's a hell of a singer. So there's that and Rainbow, you know, and that's kind of, I suppose, classic 70s rock. But also you'd have Chic and you'd have a really, you know, like I remember Start being in the charts at the same time as like Ashes to Ashes by David Bowie. And then you get into David Bowie and then you rediscover there's Robert Fripp in there. And you go, oh, yeah, he's in King Crimson. And oh, he's done stuff with Van de Graaff Generator, all the weird stuff. Robert Fripp isn't too far away. And then you might get into, you know, as I got older, I got into the more prog stuff, like through Van de Graaff Generator into, you know, Robert Wyatt and Matching Mole and Gong and, you know, all this other stuff where the guitar playing and everything was a little more free. And, you know, but also things like Velvet Underground, Patti Smith, which was all my girlfriend's record collection, and Sid Barrett, early Sid Barrett, Pink Floyd, and this kind of thing. There was a lot of good stuff, and I was in improvisation bands on saxophone and things like that in the mid late '80s, playing around in Colchester. I was in about two or three bands. Because that was what you did. It was fun, and you set up gigs at the art center, and the place was full of all of the different types of tribes that there were there. There was a lot. There was the Numad Lami people. There was the sort of Goths. There was the art school people, and just the general students, the punks and the hardcore people and the metalers, and all in one place. Because in Colchester, you had to go to where the weirdos went, because you couldn't go to squatty pubs. You'd get beaten up, especially looking like we did, I'd just be in an old jumper overalls, tweed jacket, stinking of turps and oil paint. You know, I couldn't go in a blooming army pub. There's no way. You get beaten up. So the weirdos had to stick to their own places. So we went to places and there'd be funny bands playing on all the time. And that's how I met Dave Rowntree, who in Blur, he was in a band called Idle Vice. And they were a good band in college, a slightly squatty kind of band, looking band, but good. And I played sort of saxophone with them and a band called The Curious Band, which were an improvisational sort of band, pretty hippie stuff, but good musicians. And we were just playing it because it was a laugh.
I like those gigs because we had a similar sort of upbringing in Omo, where I came from. My band would be a straight indie band, and we would be playing on the same bill as the metal band and the same one as a girl playing a ukulele and stuff. And you're really covering all ideas of energy. And the metal band hated us because we thought we were quite good looking, and we thought that they were just stinky old, what do we used to call them, soap dodgers? So they were soap dodger. And there'd be wars, everybody'd be fine, and you'd be sharing amps and everybody'd be smiling, and then you'd go back and the beginning of internet forums, and then the real fucking blood and thunder would start on the internet. But when you'd see them in the street, it'd be going, hi, how's it going? Yeah, good, yeah.
Yeah, well, there wasn't that then. There really wasn't that then, and there would be trouble. There would be trouble between them. There'd be all the usual stuff, because there was some of the New Model Army people were the hardest lads in the town, and then there'd be another, and then there'd be standoffs, there'd be fights, and then, especially with that, but it was interesting. It was kind of an interesting time, the mid to late 80s.
Did the sort of first iteration of Blur Seymour ever play gigs like that? Or did you kind of graduate past that, you don't have to start at that level because you've already played in bands that have been at that level, so you're maybe supporting bands and you're kind of a little bit further ahead when
we did do gigs like that. Actually, one of the first gigs Damon ever did was just him and this guitar player was at the Art Center as well. There was a backing track and then a guy I think called Tom who was playing the guitar and to a drum machine, really. And but when Seymour started, we were called Seymour. We were doing the Cricketers in the Oval, the Powerhouse in Angel, the George Robey, which would do all dayers, and this is how we got to know other people in bands like the Keatons. And other bands like that we'd always be bumping into during the all days at the George Robey or Lady Owen Arms, and all these places, and a lot of them are no longer with us. But all of these small pub gigs, backroom gigs, Camden Falcon, all of those things. I mean, I don't think any of them exist anymore. But there was a lot of those gigs.
What was the spark that you guys either got noticed or realized you had written a song worthy of getting noticed, if you know what I mean, where you just have that boom?
I just think we wrote some pretty good songs. We had a song called Repetition that was kind of obviously kind of good. We had She's So High pretty early on. So there was quite a few promising numbers in our set, which was 10, 12 songs at the time.
And there was
so a good half of them were decent tunes.
It was more British influenced back then, wasn't it? Like like, you know, She's So High and stuff like that was quite baggy sounding.
Baggy? Baggy, yeah, wasn't even around at that point.
Yeah, but it had that, it has that.
She's So High does.
Yeah. Or am I smoking crack right now?
Yeah, I think you might be. No, and She's So High, the it's slow.
I'm thinking of a different song.
You're thinking of There's No Other Way.
Yeah, I'm thinking of There's No Other Way. That's
which is later, which was our first sort of top 10.
Yeah.
That took advantage of a sort of a loop, a sort of a hip-hoppy kind of loop, which I suppose could have been called baggy. We stepped on baggy to go to the next station, really, and then we got off. She's So High was more, I mean, I was into My Bloody Valentine and She's a Mary Chain and the indie stuff. So I was trying to make everything sound like My Bloody Valentine, which was kind of difficult at times, but because you have to do what the song requires, you know, in the end. But She's So High and things like that, and it was also based around My Bloody Valentine and the Escalator song by Tallulah Gosh, kind of inspired the guitar playing on She's So High. But I mean, this is like ancient stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Now, be like Escalator song to Lula Gosh, what, She's So High, Blur, what are you on about? You know, it's
well, I mean,
the indie stuff, you know, you played a blues scale in that music, you were strung up,
but that's it. I mean like there's like new generations of fans like finding your music all the time. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I know kids of like that are really young finding Blur and your guitar playing, and it's as fresh to them as some new band starting out today, because it's like hitting their ears for the first time. There's certain bands that will always be like that, and Blur is one of them. And like, you know, Nirvana would be like another, and Oasis and the Prodigy. And you know, there's certain acts when you hear for the first time as a 14-year-old, and you watch actually YouTube reaction videos of kids in America who like might be 14 listening to stuff like this, and it's undeniably fresh and immediate, you know.
Yeah, I mean that's what surprised me the most, really, is that we have aged. You know, we're in our 50s, but whenever we've been on tour and we've been on the road and we've gone to Hong Kong or we've gone to South America and we've gone to Mexico, the age of the first few rows hasn't changed. You know,
they're
excited teenagers or people in their early 20s. And with the older people at the back holding drinks, you know, which is bizarre, because people, although the sort of tribalism of music has kind of disappeared, and there's no real such thing as selling out anymore as much as there used to be, you know, because musicians have got to earn money somehow, and new musicians and new bands and things like that seem to be kind of business savvy. It's not the same thing at all. So that, yeah, the whole internet is, it can be explored, and it's all sitting there in like a big freezer, as fresh as the day it was made, and people just go, yeah, that's a bit of that.
Yeah,
it's weird.
But the fact that people do keep finding it and discovering it for the first time, does that make you continue wanting to be able to go and tour it and play it and show it what it's like live?
Yeah, I guess so. Every now and then it's nice to go and play in front of a big smiley audience with your amp turned up loud, you know, it's a pretty good job. It's nice to have good reason to do it. You can't just do it because you want a bit of adoration, you know. Yeah, you usually have to make something new and then take that around the place. So, yeah, it's great.
I remember I went on a pilgrimage to see you guys play live because you were my favorite band when I was a kid, when I was like about maybe, I don't know, whenever Great Escape came out, which is like maybe 98. So I would have been about 10, 9. And I remember getting that record and taking the day off school and writing all the lyrics down of it and pretending I was sick and singing them all back and just thinking,
oh, really?
Yeah. Like it was a real, I remember my auntie caught me and said, I'm not going to tell your mom you're sick. And I was just like, thank you. And I just sat there just writing all the lyrics down and trying to memorize them. But I went to see you play the reunion show or the comeback show in London when I was 18 or 19. And yeah. We decided, I was quite into the Libertines at the time. So we went to Filthy McNasty's just before it closed down. And we drank all day in Filthy McNasty's, almost got knocked out by some guy who looked like Lars Ulrich. And then went to the show, and Vampire Weekend and Bat for Lashes were supporting, and it was fucking great. Not really a question. It was just a great day.
It was a good bill.
A very good bill, man. Like when you can pick bands like that, is it quite fun where you can just go, all right, let's get X, Y, and Z, because you kind of have it.
Yeah, we kind of chose anybody, you know. I mean, on some of our London ones, Deerhoof played, you know. Yeah. Can we get Deerhoof? And I said, oh, they'll never do it. And then they did, you know. And and it's like, great. And I remember, you know, the Crystal Castles played and you know, they came along to do that. And so it is interesting because that we're all into kind of like different things. And what is nice is that my default setting is like, oh no, they wouldn't want to do it, but then they do, you know, and they fly over and do the show, and we have a chat and it's kind of cool. Yeah, it is nice. Yeah.
Do you do much producing for other people at the moment? I remember you did that Pete Doherty record. What was it called?
Grace/Wastelands.
Yes, that's it. I mean, listen,
that was a Stephen Street production, but I was kind of there as a sort of a cohort for Pete, really, I suppose, to play along with Pete on some of the acoustic numbers and to sort of wear similar shoes, you know, and just be around. You know, that was great. Actually, Pete was a joy. During those, he had tons of stuff around his blooming neck. He had about 10 chains with various lumps hanging off them, which would be cracking onto the guitar all the time. So a lot of the recordings, you can hear the jangling and the banging of the chains on acoustic guitars, which is kind of nice, actually.
But yeah.
It sent the street slightly mad.
But like, do you enjoy sort of like working with other people on their music rather than just on your own stuff?
Do I? I don't know. If they're all right, if they're, you know, I haven't done it an awful lot and it can be exhausting. But I don't mind if they're good personalities and really, you know, if they're tricky and challenging sort of personalities, then that would be difficult. I mean, I don't know whether I'm that good at it.
Well, I mean, being a producer, there's a high percentage of it that is psychological, and you kind of have to be a little bit of a therapist and to be able to get stuff out of people, isn't it?
It is, really. You do have to have a sort of nurturing side. You are actually like the studio dad.
Yeah, yeah.
And Stephen was like that for us a lot of the time, I think. He'd have to be encouraging and he'd have to be patient. And the thing is about Stephen, he was always immaculate. You know, he was always very, very consistent in his approach, in his mood and everything. So you knew exactly where you were with him all the time, whereas other producers can be a bit more erratic. And you go in one morning and, you know, you realise that the producer's been, you know, had a bottle of Jameson's and woke up with his face in a pizza, and it's like, oh man, it's basically a tough one.
this is going to be a hard day. But I mean, like at the peak of your access back in the day, I would imagine that you would really need somebody to steer that ship, because there probably was an element of cliche when you were like all of you were indulging yourselves in all of the finery of rock and roll at that time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it got that bad. We were, I suppose, when we were making The Great Escape, it was the heaviest because we were, we were sort of making that whilst we were going to a lot of award ceremonies for Park Life, and the world had opened up to us a lot more after Park Life, so there's a lot more parties and things like that. But generally, you know, we were pretty young. I mean, the hangovers could get pretty bad, but we would never. I'd love going to the studio. I mean, it didn't matter. I mean, I would never try and bunk off of going to the studio. I still, that's my favourite place. So no matter how I was feeling, I'd drag myself, get myself there.
Do you think that then people have like mythologized your level of partying, or they have overstated it, like for purposes of mythology, really?
I don't think we did party that much, did we?
I mean, when you've got people like Alex talking about spending £1 million on cocaine and champagne and stuff like that, yeah, it's kind of hard to like say that he's dead. And like,
well, I mean, that's like saying that we all support Chelsea. I mean, just what one person does is not the same. I mean, I
yeah, of course.
I didn't go out with Alex every night. You know, he was into a sort of quite a pop star-y sort of thing, and he was adventurous, and he would go out finding these kind of glamorous things, and he would drink champagne and, you know, and all the rest of it. I unfortunately, I guess, didn't have the confidence to pull that off. I mean, I found myself in those situations, I'd become a little bit more snarling rather than sort of glamorous. I'd become the opposite, and I'd sort of resent it, and then I'd have a little bit to drink, and I'd start snarling, and my defences would go up, and then, so really, in the end, and
two sides of a different coin. Like, it was just like things.
Yeah, like simple things in life, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was partying, but I mean, there were times when you very quickly knew your limit, you know, like,
yeah,
2 months in the States, and suddenly, you know, you're 21 or 22, 23, and no one to tell you what to do. Everything is free, and you've got, and, you know, after 2 or 3 weeks, you don't know why you don't know why you're crying all the time. What's going on? I'm going mad. And it's like, well, because you've been, you know,
you've been drinking for like 3 weeks.
And you've been drinking, and you know, it's like, is that what it is? Is that what it does? Yeah. It's like, oh. You know, you get to the point where, oh, this is what happens when you're like burning yourself.
But I think I had that as well, but like just after uni. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I think I went through the exact same thing, because like when you finish uni, you're trying to find your way in the world. But I mean, the only difference is I wasn't in a very famous rock and roll band. I was in a band that was still playing quite a lot of shows, but everything was cheap and nasty and available. Yeah. So like it was.
I always liken it to Rumpelstiltskin, where they put you in a room, and there's loads of free drink in it, and the bloke says, drink that, get on stage. So you drink it, you feel really cool, you get on stage, you do a blind, and then the next day you get into a slightly bigger room with a slightly bigger pile of free booze, drink that, play a good show. You do that, and the rooms get bigger, the piles of free booze get bigger, and then before you know it, you're like, you wake up and you're like, and you feel like you're going mad.
It's true though. I mean, like, I remember a friend of mine saying to me, he was just like, being a musician is the only profession where you get paid in a depressive. Like, you know, you go and play a gig and you get 4 red stripe to play before you go on, and then that's it.
Yeah.
So it is weird. Do you still have like a as much of a love for Billy Childish? Cause like, and his music and his art and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. I haven't seen Billy for ages, but yeah, I do. We haven't had a chat for a while, but I think he, you know, I used to go and see him a lot in the mid-90s, early to mid-90s at St. John's Tavern.
Very in.
Archway.
Yeah.
and obviously I put some of his song is some records out on my old label, and we became pretty good friends, Uncle Bill, and I hadn't seen him for a bit, but he quieted down, like, he concentrated on painting. And
Have you ever been on the shop on his website? It's incredible. He's like literally got, it's amazing. I was buying a present for somebody who loves Billy Childish, and I was like looking to buy a painting, and it's just like I wasn't quite aware of like how much stuff he had done until I went onto his website, and I was like, so he's like a musician, he's an artist, he makes like pendants, and he does like, I was like, this guy's like the most creative fucker I've ever seen.
No, he does a lot of stuff, and his enthusiasm and drive for that is pretty inspiring, actually. Yeah, he and his painting has always been, it's just something he does, he has a real drive in that way, and it's great. Lots more than I have.
When we're coming out of lockdown kind of now, like, I mean, as we record this anyway, it's like the 12th of May. So like things are, I don't know what the fuck normal is anymore, but like, what is it that you're looking to do? Are you looking to go away or travel or write more or record? Like, what would you like to be doing that you weren't able to do?
I don't know. I've been quite happy.
some people it suits, like, I mean, first couple of months,
yeah, I mean, it's opening now. I've got a certain amount of anxiety about it opening out and going out there and being amongst people and stuff, but I'm looking forward to having some nice food in a restaurant, maybe being amongst the human race. Not particularly, I've always liked being amongst people, not necessarily sociably, when I used to go out on my own and things, I used to just be like being amongst people and feeling part of the human race. I didn't particularly always want to interact, but I wanted to feel part of it. So I'm sort of looking forward to that a little bit, maybe going on a couple of jaunts. I'm quite happy, really.
That's it, man. If you're content, then you're content. And like, I mean, I've got most of my stuff that I needed within these walls anyway. It's just nice to get out. It's just nice not to have to stay in. It's nice to have the option, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it is good now the summer's coming, and there's going to be a few people about where I live up in North London here. It's going to be a bit more of a jolly vibe, I suppose.
Yeah, big time, man. Listen, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me, stopping by the podcast, sharing that demo of Yoga Town, and creating this great music and bringing a lot of joy to people's lives.
Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your $1 a month trial today at shopify.com/records.